This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hey, hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on September 16th, 2009, and we're going to talk about codeplex.org and then some random news stuff, and we'll see what happens. So, I'll start with one thing. I think that by far, which I know a lot of people said this, they were almost a little surprised, but the best analysis by far I saw this was from Scott Belware. Did you guys see what he had written on that? It spelled it out really cleanly to me.
It was surprisingly optimistic.
Yes.
And not at all skeptical.
Not at all. It was incredible. Yeah, I think an endorsement from Scott on anything Microsoft does says quite a bit. He's definitely, you know, he's definitely positioned that. The things I saw about it was, like, number one, he was saying, like, okay, wrote up the history and why open source has been so difficult for, in the Microsoft world, for developers and for, especially for Microsoft developers. And it's just, you know, there's concerns over intellectual property, the code pedigree and all that. And then he talked about how painful it is for those of us who are aware of what's going on in the open source world to continually run up against reinventions of things that are better in open source and then watch Microsoft reinvent them and then get stuck using the lame knockoff. And so he was talking about, you know, well, that's the problem we're solving. And then the solutions are, you know, number one, by having this magical foundation, then companies, including Microsoft, will be able to trust open source and work with open source, which is a little bit like, you know, the diagram where it says, and some magic happens, and you know, like, it's not really very well spelled out. And then he talked about, you know, what are some problems? There's the distrust, and there's also they're kind of the way it works is you're supposed to assign your copyright over to the foundation. That's one of the ways they're going to help out. And then they own the copyright, you license it back, and you keep coding away. And this, so now instead of, you know, MegaCore saying, yeah, we're going to have to use, you know, Kevin's lame ORM, we're going to use something from, you know, codeplex.org. And, you know, so we'll trust it. That's what I got out of it.
Well, so there's a couple of reasons to do the licensing and the copyright. And there's actually two ways to go about this. And I've had to read far more than I ever wanted to, simply because I opened my big mouth on Twitter. So the two ways that they're looking at this is you can either transfer copyright to codeplex.org. This is the way that the jQuery Foundation and I think the Apache Software Foundation also do it. The Eclipse Foundation may do it this way too. And that way, that, you know, yes, codeplex.org then owns the copyright, and then they own the copyright. And what that means is, what it boils down to is that if the project, if the main contributor stops contributing, the project doesn't die. They can accept other contributions. They can relicense it to new developers who will pick it up and go on. Or in any of the in-hybrid project, had a comment at the Google groups when I mentioned this, and he said, but that's how it works now. Yeah, but it's, you know, there's always this heavy legal black cloud hanging over those projects. You know, you never know when the original contributor is going to come back and say, no, you can't do that, I own the copyright, and someone else who's picked it up may not be able to, and then they have to fork and go on. I mean, if you fork it, for most open source licenses, you're okay. You fork it, own the new copyright on it, you go from there. So the other way that the contributor agreements work with codeplex.org is that you can actually license it to codeplex.org. You provide some kind of a license, and it's not the same as transferring copyright. You still retain your rights, but it has some other advantage, and that's the part where my knowledge breaks down. The big questions are, so how are they going to accomplish these goals that they've set forth? How are, you know, is it just going to be that they go around and basically unspin the Microsoft FUD around open source that has been spinning for the last 10 years? Are they going to get Ballmer to stop saying Linux and open source is a cancer? Are they going to, you know, work to change attitudes and towards open source within, you know, this closed proprietary source community, or how exactly are they going to do this stuff? So far, the comments that have come out of the board of directors have been very confusing. and I don't know what else to say about that. They're still in the early phases, and so it's kind of like they don't quite know what they're doing. And that may be true, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It means they get to find their way. But it still kind of feels like they've created this separate open source community, because that's what communities like the jQuery Foundation, Mozilla Foundation, the Apache Software Foundation, and et al. Have been trying to do for years and decades now, is to change attitudes towards open source, provide safe havens, provide, you know, all this kind of brokering and stuff like that for open source devs. And so now CodePlex.org comes along, and they're going to do it because they're Microsoft and they're changing their attitudes. And isn't that great? Yeah. But, you know, I can't help feel that they're kind of falling into this, what was the name of the character in Office Space who just took the requirements from the customer and handed it to the developers? You know, they've got people skills, I guess.
Right.
That's all I'm going to say about that.
Kevin?
So it seems like this entity, or whatever you want to call it, I mean, can serve a lot of different purposes. What I'm not sure of is which one it's actually going to end up serving. I mean, you know, one of the things that the CodePlex Foundation can do is build a strong, richer open source community around the Microsoft development platform. So that's an obvious one, and that should be kind of a no-brainer. Another thing that it can do is provide a conduit by which Microsoft employees can contribute to open source projects, which, you know, Microsoft has always been persnickety about their developers even reading open source code due to freaky, you know, paranoia about licensing stuff. And I think they've said that that's one of the goals also. You know, is this, you know, this another thing that could come out of this would be Microsoft actually recommending some open source technologies as viable, you know, tools for their customers to use. You know, is that going to happen? I don't know. And finally, there's, you know, are they going to actually consider incorporating open source technology in their own software, you know, the way that, for example, Apple has been able to do, but which Microsoft, with the whole jQuery thing being the one exception, has been dramatically unwilling to do. So I don't know which of those things are going to happen or not happen, but it seems like that, you know, all of those are sort of in the cards as possibilities.
Okay, Scott, any thoughts?
Sure. I thought it was a pretty interesting move, kind of exciting, and I think it'll take about maybe 1 year to 2 years to determine what level of success they're going to achieve. And to me, success would really be three things, and this is just my perspective. I'm sure they won't have any problems getting some projects on board, but I don't think that would be a really good measure of success, even if they got the 12 highest profile open source projects in the .NET space on board. I don't think that by itself would be a success. I think success to me would be, one, we'd see more uptake of open source libraries and projects inside of corporations. So we've all been inside of the companies that don't want to use things like in Hibernate or open source logging libraries and things like that because they're just scared of open source. So I think one measure of success is in 2 years from now, we can say, yes, there's been a measurable uptake of open source inside of large corporations. The second thing I'd look for in 2 years is to say, has Microsoft actually taken any successful open source components and shipped them as part of Visual Studio or shipped them as part of Windows or packaged them up somehow, just like they've done with jQuery? So it'd be great if Visual Studio came with more libraries right out of the box. So something like a mocking framework, inversion of controlled container, unit test runner, unit testing framework. Of course, that'll open up a whole other can of worms about which one they actually ship, but at least that would be a more interesting discussion than why are they ignoring all these great tools. And then the third thing I think that would be really interesting is if this allowed Microsoft developers and people inside of Microsoft to use open source projects, not just in building software in their day-to-day work, but to actually sit down and look at something like NUnit and say, well, what makes this a success? And what could we add to our environment to augment that project? Not try to replace it, but try to embrace it inside of Visual Studio without killing it off. And I think those three things will take a couple years before we can actually see if it's been a success or not.
Yeah, I'd made a little list of three things I thought were important and that like overlaps pretty well with what I was thinking. I had legitimize open source, accept open source, and fund open source effectively. And so I was thinking like legitimize is like, you know, by Microsoft stamping their name on this and saying it's okay to use open source, and especially these things we're kind of putting, we're standing behind in this sort of standing behind way, then, you know, that's good. Because I've run into things where, you know, a lot of software developers just don't get or are scared whenever they see like legal stuff, anything. It's like, I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to do any license. And, you know, like I've gone back and forth with Jeff Atwood and other people where they're like, it's just code, just do whatever. I don't care. You know? And it's like, no, you actually have to give code away so someone can use it. And so I think that that's just not part of our culture. And so for Microsoft to, you know, in kind of a public way, say, yes, it's, you know, we kind of encourage you to use this code, it's good stuff, you know, then that would definitely make our job easier in terms of using it. And then accepting it is something like, I forget exactly who it was. It might have been Damien Gard we talked to recently with Link to SQL. And you know, other people too, where we've said, you know, like, look, why did you do it this way when other people have already solved this problem and did it kind of in a more elegant way? And they'd say, well, we're not allowed to look at that. And, you know, not even allowed to like look at the feature list, really, like can't even study how it works from the outside. And I've run into that with some things like, I mean, it's just something I was working on open source, and there it was hosted on Google Code, and they said, well, you know, if you moved it to CodePlex, we'd be allowed to look at it, you know. And it's like, it's a subversion repository, like, you know, but there's just kind of concerns. And so like that would, I would love to see Microsoft being able to just get their foot in the pool and actually like leverage it the way that everybody else does, you know, like Apple's able to make tons of money by packaging open source stuff. And that kind of overlaps with what you were saying. The one other thing I'm thinking is funding. I think it would be great if, I think Google Summer of Code has just been so effective. And I think that everything that Microsoft's probably done and most big companies try to do to, you know, just throw money at open source is usually a waste of time. I was looking back at something where Jeff Atwood donated $5,000 to ScrewTurn Wiki, and it was a nice gesture, but it just kind of, they didn't know what to do with the money. And I really think like this is something where like, you know, have interns work on something, you know, and it's beautiful how it works. Like you look at GIMP or Audacity or Inkscape, those are some of my favorites, but you know, any big open source project on SourceForge or, you know, out in the kind of non-Microsoft world gets interns that go through the bug list or add awesome features. And it's the lifeblood of these projects, you know? And so it'd be great to see Microsoft do something like that instead of just kind of like random spastic throwing money at something that doesn't really go anywhere. So that's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah. Oren Enni had mentioned that as well. He said, you know, even if it's just hiring a developer for a few years or a few months or to work on some open source or sponsoring somebody or providing CI servers and things like that. And yeah, I don't think that money is necessarily going to solve the open source dilemma. And again, I'm still not sure how they're going to accomplish their goals. I've been, you know, evangelizing open source for a while. Every company I've worked at, and they've all had some, you know, reason for why they can't use it. And so I don't know how Microsoft throwing $1 million at a new organization is going to suddenly change that attitude. They're still going to have the same problems. They're going to have the same excuses. You know, well, if the project goes away, then, you know, then I have to maintain it. Or who do I call for support? Things like that. But I do agree that they need to put their mouth where their money is now and start shipping some open source things on the DVD, the Windows DVD, the big one. They still haven't shipped jQuery with Visual Studio yet. That's not coming until 2010. In fact, it may not be on there still because, as we'll talk about a little later, they've launched this new CDN for their Ajax APIs. So, you know, they may never ship it on the DVD. They did ship it with the MVC download, but it's not on the DVD. It won't be on the Visual Studio install until 2010. And so I'd like to see them include, you know, they don't have to put stuff like the GIMP on there or things like that, but because don't know that I'd wish the GIMP on anybody. I don't know that it makes sense for them to ship Firefox on there, even though generally the first thing that everyone installs. But I think there's certainly some holes in there where they could ship some open source things. I don't have any off the top of my head right now that I'd have to research some. Trying to think of the favorite things that I install. They're all developer related. So I don't know if that really applies.
Well, you know, just some quick thoughts on that. Like, number one is that they do seem very concerned about the whole media and DVD thing. This was explained to me that, you know, like there's the nightmare scenario of having to pull, you know, millions of boxes off the shelves, you know, and getting an injunction where you can't sell Windows for 6 months or something until we verify, you know, like that kind of thing. So there's a concern there with that. And I'm not saying that there's no reason why they couldn't include it on the DVD or include a separate CD of like some awesome free stuff, you know, the plus pack that happens to all be open source, and just ship that in the box too as a separate CD, and then you can just pull them out. It's no big deal. But then also the internet really has changed things where the need for physical media kind of goes away. Like Windows 7, they've shipped a lot of stuff as Windows Live Essentials, I think it is. And, you know, I don't see a reason why, like, K. Scott Allen, you've said, like, paint.net or something like that, you know, throw some third-party stuff on there, open or closed source, that, you know, just to make it awesome. The one other thing is you mentioned GIMP, and, you know, there's no real reason why they couldn't ship GIMP. And there is the, like, do you want to wish that on anyone side of it? Sure. But I'm just thinking, like, everybody else, Apple, Google, everybody, you know, all the major competitors ship code they didn't write and they get paid for it. And there's no real good reason why that I can come up with why Microsoft couldn't just ship GIMP, you know, like ship it, do follow the legal requirements. You've got a lot of lawyers, bundle the source if you have to, whatever, but there's no reason why that couldn't be either a, you know, shipped on this bonus CD or shipped as a download that's, you know, right off the start bar, get awesome free software, you know, in the Microsoft funky marketplace thing.
Yeah, I don't, the whole, like, shipping it on the CD is not a big deal to me. You know, if the first thing that comes up when you install Windows is it has a start page that says, hey, look, here's all this cool software you can get for free, that would be fine for me. Like, I don't need them. Even the jQuery thing, like, their endorsement of jQuery is more valuable to me than their including jQuery in the box. I don't really expect them to ship competing technologies of their own stuff. I mean, Apple is not shipping Firefox along with Safari on their product DVD. I don't think that's really realistic. But, you know, all those extra tools that make their platform more valuable to their customers seem like, you know, making it easy for their customers to get those things only enhances the value of their platform. So it does seem like a no-brainer. And the thing, like the web platform installer thing that they have for installing, you know, blog engines and you know, CMS engines and whatever, like, that's a perfect model to me. Like, here's a nice little gateway to tons of cool open source stuff.
Anybody? Are we running out of stuff?
I mean, it's just so early. And every time that you mention something about the foundation, you have 40 people saying, it's too early, give them a chance. Like, but they asked for my feedback. I was giving them feedback.
I guess it's good that they're at least in a spot where they're not like, okay, here's our 5-year plan and that kind of thing. Like, it's maybe a little too nebulous, but it's at least something where, you know, they're open to change. What do you guys think about the board members that they've got? So they've got Sam Ramji, who's been a good champion for open source at Microsoft, but's leaving within a month. And then we've got several Microsoft people and Miguel Diacaza and Sean Walker from .NET Nuke. And was that it? I mean, there were like two people that don't work at Microsoft.
Two non-Microsoft. Miguel, who works for Novell, who is, I don't know, heavily financially or legally somehow entwined with Microsoft in terms of patents or agreement not to sue their Linux users or something like that. And you've got Sean Walker of the .NET Nuke Corporation, who is, some would say, heavily embedded with Microsoft. I would just point out that, you know, I don't think they're anything seedy about that. I think he's built a successful business on the Microsoft platform that provides software that is at least in the spirit of open source, if not using an exclusive OSI blessed license. But it is a good point that there are three members of the board, interim board. It should be stressed that this is only an interim board that work for Microsoft, one of whom is leaving Microsoft, and there are two others who work for people who are strongly partnered with Microsoft. I made the suggestion that perhaps one of the laws that the board adopts is that a company can only have a single member on the board of directors at any given time. I thought that was pretty reasonable, and it's not necessarily to punish any one company, but I think it's to increase the diversity of the board. Because the way it is now, if the board decides to do something and Miguel and Sean don't agree, I don't know that they can necessarily, you know, stall it or stop it. I think they have to have a 3-2 vote, or is it a 4-1 vote to pass anything? We should look that up. If only there was some mechanism for looking up information online. Maybe I'll use Bing Visual Search to search for the PDFs.
Was that a segue?
Well, let me just say on that I do think in some ways it would have been better for them to come out with no board than a heavily Microsoft employees board. I do think that was a bit of a PR gaffe, because it just looks like it's kind of a puppet organization. At the very least, Microsoft should have a minority position on the board. And I know it's, you know, transition and whatever, but, you know, it just the optics aren't very good when that's the first thing people see out of the gate. Oh, here it is. You know, here's our great foundation that we have total control over.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that balances this a little bit, and I mean, you're kind of depending on the good of people and stuff like that, but if you look at the background of the people they pulled into this, I don't know some of them, but like, they've got two things then. They've got a board of directors, and they have advisors or something? They have an advisor board? So, yeah, okay, so the advisory board, then they've got several other people. Somebody from Hewlett-Packard, Sugar CRM, Rob Connery, who wasn't at Microsoft and then was at Microsoft and then is not at Microsoft. But so there, you know, there's some non-Microsoft influence there, although I don't know what advisory does.
They don't have any voting capabilities.
True.
At all.
I guess what I was starting to say is that some of these other people, like Dee Britton Johnston, has a background in PHP and stuff like that. So I don't I don't know really what that helps.
I'm going to let you finish, John, and I respect you, but I just wanted to say the Apache Software Foundation is the best foundation around.
Hmm. So that is the question then, and that's several people asked that over Twitter. Bill Simser says, how do you say his name? Bill, I need to read this. Bill Simser asked, what do they add, or is there an overlap with other foundations? I think, to me, you know, you pointed out earlier, Scott, that you've got the jQuery Foundation, the Apache Software Foundation, you've got Mozilla, that all these people that kind of the foundations are focused around an interest. So to me, it seems like it makes sense to have a foundation that's focused around the interest of expanding open source in the Microsoft on the Microsoft platform. Like, I don't know how they would get this into Apache, say, for instance, the Apache Software Foundation without, like, ramming this weird thing down everyone's throat, and people are like, what are you guys doing? That's not what we do here, you know? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, Log4Net is an Apache project. I mean, it's not totally unheard of to have .NET stuff managed under its auspices.
If all they were trying to do was have, you know, like this, the safe haven, then I could agree with that, you know, like they would just could work out some deal where Apache Software Foundation, they encouraged people that were on CodePlex or, you know, started moving Microsoft's things into Apache Software Foundation. But it sounds like there's other goals there too, like, you know, encouraging more use of open source in Microsoft, you know, maybe there's this internships or other things. And so that doesn't seem like that fits in to me. I don't know. It's so early.
It's too early. I don't have any problem with them starting their own foundation. I mean, they are a corporation. They're investing money. They should have, you know, some level of influence over the structure. I do think they have to be careful that everything that they do in the open source community will be treated with some measure of distrust. And I think they would be wise to keep that in mind in their decision-making process, that they, you know, they're starting from a position where people, you know, automatically assume the worst of them. And so it would be smart of them to, you know, take that into consideration when they're making announcements or making decisions. How can they mitigate that sort of inherent distrust that people have developed over the years? You know, that distrust is, of course, for the most part, of their own cause. So, you know, it's not like it's misplaced distrust.
Okay, Scott?
Yeah, I think it's pretty reasonable for them to start a foundation. I wouldn't like to see everything lumped under a single foundation, even as great as the Apache Foundation is. For the same reason, I don't want to only see one web browser or one mortgage bank.
Fair enough. So during this conversation, something keeps coming up, and it's Bing Visual Search. And it just throughout this past week, it just keeps coming up because it's part of everyone's life right now. And Scott K., can you explain how Bing Visual Search has changed your life?
I now have a new punchline for jokes. I tried it, and I was expecting something much, much more impressive. After hearing everyone talk about it and how nice it was. It's just a freaking, you know, kind of carousel for images. And you click on it and it drills down into a regular image search or web search. And I don't really get the visual aspect of it. And it only had certain galleries that you could use. I didn't understand what problem they were solving. Was, you know, regular searching not visual enough?
To me, yeah, okay. So the catalogs that they have are pretty silly. Like, you've got, I mean, some of them are useful. There's politicians, there's movies in theaters. So I can imagine, you know, okay, I want to see that movie, and I remember it's got cute dogs in it, but I can't remember the name. So I think this maybe solves some of that it's on the tip of my tongue problem, you know, where you want to look something up, but you don't know the words to start with. So I could see that being helpful, but it seems like this UI is definitely a V1 in terms of doing that. You know, I would think that you could do something that kind of expands out a little better, more kind of like a 20 questions feel or something, you know, that kind of animal, vegetable, mineral that kind of helps you locate what you're looking for. And this kind of keys off to me as, you know, this is something where like shows how Wolfram Alpha does this kind of stuff really neatly, not this particular problem, but solves information management. And then in terms of what's in here, you've got like, you've got some normal things, you know, like I was saying, and then you've got the FBI's most wanted list. You've got yoga poses, which, you know, I don't know. So yeah.
Well, so I go to it and I click on the movies in theater and it starts me at newest, which is kind of nice. But then it says my location is Tukwila, Washington. When I'm in North Seattle, which is like 45 minutes away from Tukwila. So, you know, whatever. That's fine. I have the option to change it. But then half of the images are missing. They're just white rectangles. And so I have to hover over them, and then it changes, you know, the search bar up there. But I don't know how this helps me. So, like, if I want to see Whiteout, if I click on this, what is it going to take me to? Is it going to take me to reviews of it or movie times? Or if I click on it, it just takes me to a search for Whiteout movie. Well, I could have just typed that in without doing the visual part. I'm not understanding it. I don't see what it's solving, how it's helping me. Dog breeds. Maybe this is better. What's that dog that I saw this afternoon? But then it goes from A to Z. Well, okay, sure. But, okay, so I see it now. It's a greyhound. And then, I don't know, it just takes me to a search for greyhound dog. Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, well, another example of where it's just utterly pointless is the iPhone app search engine, little sub-engine here, where, you know, not a bad idea to have a special, you know, iPhone app little specialized vertical search where they've got, you know, top 10 free apps and top 10 paid apps. And I'm sure this is all info you can get from iTunes, of course. But then in the visual part, they're showing you essentially the icon of the iPhone app as it would appear, you know, sort of in your phone. And then if you click on that thing, it's just doing a search on the name of the app, like a regular Bing search. Like, what purpose does that serve? What value does showing me the stupid little icon You know, how does that improve my searching of that thing in any way? It just seems utterly pointless. It seems very gee whiz, like we can do this not for any particular reason, but just because we want to do something that looks kind of slick and maybe uses Silverlight. Ooh.
Well, see, I thought it was going to be more interactive. Like, I thought it was going to be, and I know this is a little too technical for the target audience of a search engine, but I thought it was going to be like a pivot table I could manipulate. So, you know, if it was searching by things in terms of rank or, you know, number of stars for movies or, you know, MPAA rating, something like that, I'd be able to manipulate this and drill down. So I'd be able to say, okay, so I just want to see, you know, this. And you can kind of do that with their left one, their left-hand menu. You can say, show me the newest, and it kind of, you know, just does a little research, yeah, or not a research, a refresh of everything. But it still doesn't do much more than that. I thought I'd be able to, you know, swap them around and personalize the results. I don't know.
See, as we're talking, I'm seeing more of a use for it. I just think the UI is not there yet, or it's not filled out with enough information yet. Because, for instance, that iPhone apps, yeah, that is kind of a weird case. But let's say you've got your iPhone and you're showing me, or I've seen your iPhone and you've got this cool thing and it's got a picture of a football on it. Well, it's like, well, which one is that? You know, and like, so you've got this problem where if you know the words, you can find the picture. But if you've got the picture, you don't know the word. And, you know, so say like I'm looking at NBA players. Okay, so I'm watching TV and somebody, you know, I see somebody and I go, oh, yeah, who's that guy? You know, that guy. And I'm waiting for him to like say his name when he does something. But, you know, so this would be something where I could maybe connect the visual back to the words. I think that, you know, there's not enough information here, so it's kind of silly and it's hard to see it. But I think that does solve a problem. If there was enough where you could actually like drill in and find something you'd want to find out. But, you know, like famous actors, they don't have very many on here. They've got film legends, but, you know, like I'm always doing that. I'll see a movie and I don't know who's in the movie. And then I'm like, is that so-and-so? No, it's not them. Is that so, you know, and I have to. So I think it could go somewhere. I just don't think there's enough here to judge it or to get anything useful yet.
I'm starting to sense a theme for this podcast. It's just not quite there yet.
We don't have enough information. Okay.
It's just too new. Give them time. They're only in beta.
Right. So today Microsoft released this Ajax CDN thing where they're hosting Microsoft Ajax libraries, jQuery, as well as then it was later announced they're hosting the jQuery validation library, which is going to be used more in MVC2. What do you guys think?
I think it's an interesting idea. It's a good idea. It was a good idea when Yahoo did it, and it was a good idea when Google did it again. Yahoo, of course, only hosted their own files, but, you know, hey, that's their prerogative. That's what you're supposed to do. Google hosts a wide variety of files, everything from VXTJS to Dojo to Prototype to Scriptaculous to SWF Object, pretty much everything but the MS Ajax file. So I guess that's why Microsoft had to do a CDN so they could serve out the MS ASP.NET Ajax files. It's kind of funny that all of these CDNs all use Akamai underneath. You know, so people always say, well, you know, we can't host our JavaScript files off of, we can't load them off of a CDN because what if Microsoft or Google goes down? And I'm saying, well, you don't really have to worry about Microsoft or Google being the ones down. You have to worry about Akamai. And if Akamai goes down, then no one's going anywhere on the internet.
Yep. Kevin, K. Scott, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it was a good move. It's something they eventually had to do, I think.
Yeah, I'm kind of mad on it. You know, it's one of the things that they probably had to do, but will have no real impact in anything I ever do. I mean, I don't know that I would use them over Google for jQuery, and I'm not really doing a whole lot with MS Ajax these days. And don't know a lot of people on the broader web that are. So I don't know if it's really going to, you know, actually have a real major impact. But, you know, doesn't hurt anything.
Well, so one of the things that they did was they modified the script manager control in ASP.NET so that it now has an enable CDN attribute on it so that if you want to switch all of those web forms apps that are using ASP.NET Ajax to use the CDN. It's just a matter of changing the tag. So I think it'll get a lot of use. I think that getting those JavaScript files distributed around is always a good thing, even if it's
Aren't most of those web forums, ASP.NET, Ajax apps running inside the firewall in corporate intranets where you really probably want to be loading that stuff from the local LAN anyways?
Depends.
Unless you're Microsoft.com, of course. But
yeah, and that's the point. All these things load from Ajax.microsoft.com. I got that argument from a couple of people at a job I worked at where I said we should really host jQuery from Google. And they said, well, you know, it's fine if you're a little Web 2.0 matchup, but we're far too enterprisey. You know, so they might have that port blocked at the firewall. And I said, do you think they're going to have port 80 to Google blocked at the firewall? You never know.
Right. Like you were saying, there's the opportunity maybe where they'll leverage it, and if they can say, well, we assume or the default is that you're going to be pulling jQuery or Ajax from here, then we can add some tooling, or maybe actually jQuery IntelliSense might even actually work on my computer. It's possible in the year 2 million. So there's that. One thing that I thought was interesting, and Barry Dorans pointed this out, his blog at ideno.org, was that the scripts are hosted on ajax.microsoft.com. And so he said that, you know, from a security point of view, you've got the fact that you've got cookies going back and forth on the microsoft.com site. So there's potentially some security concerns over tracking. And then also he pointed out the whole thing of the HTTPS versus HTTP for these. I don't know. All the security stuff's way over my head, but there's maybe some interesting things there.
The SSL hosting's coming, as well as versioning. So you'll be able to pull older versions of jQuery or specific versions of the MS Ajax libraries, as far as I know.
But for instance, that would explain to me the security point of it. It doesn't Google host them at googleapis.com or something? It's not google.com. Anything else there? We're done with this.
It's very simple. One and done.
Zune's released. Does anyone care?
Well, so one thing that Brad Wilson pointed out is that the Zune Pass now has a Silverlight player so that you can access your Zune Pass from any PC now, which is pretty cool. You don't have to have I think before you had to have the Zune desktop software installed on there to access Zune Pass.
Right.
Right. And so you'd have your account scattered all over your PCs. You'd have one at your mom's house, one at work, one on your laptop, one upstairs, one downstairs, one in the guest bathroom, and you know, wherever else you had a PC. Now you can just, I guess, log into the site and play your Zune Pass there.
And
through Silverlight, so it means it works on a Mac too, at least Intel Mac. Not that I'm bitter.
I guess that is one of the selling points of Zune, is that they've got this all-you-can-eat subscription. It didn't really work for me. I didn't find enough of the music I liked, but assuming that they have the music you like, I guess that's great. Then you've got it. You've got all your songs, and like you're saying, you can play them anywhere, and you can download more of them and listen to them and keep some of them.
So I've been using Last.fm a lot more than I have any kind of subscription or even my iPod, just because I found that I really don't care so much about individual songs all the time. But sometimes, you know, I just want to say, okay, I just want to listen to everyone like Miles Davis, including Miles Davis. So just, you know, punch Miles Davis in and let it go. It does a pretty good job of, you know, coming up with stuff. It's a lot better than me having to hunt through, you know, subscription music service and find all of the artists that I want to add in to my pass. I don't know. That's me. I don't know why I like Last.fm over Pandora either. I can't explain that. I just do.
No, I totally agree. I find, as you know, as I've gotten older and have less free time, that I just don't have the time or energy to like manage music anymore. You know, find new stuff, like manage a big library of ripped music. Just the convenience of, you know, being able to say, yeah, this is the kind of stuff I like, now go find me some, is like totally compelling to me.
Yeah, there's the whole thing of like not wanting to own stuff anymore. Like, you know, like I don't really want to own 40 gigs of music, and I don't want to own, you know, millions of ripped DVDs and stuff. I'd rather just have cool stuff around when I want it. And like you're saying, Scott, like Last.fm's been good to me. Pandora recently, I looked at that, and the website's ridiculous, but the music's good. And then Hype Machine's been good. It's hypem.com. It just seems like there's plenty of good music around without, I don't know, having to constantly buy more of it. Okay, Scott, did you have any thoughts about that?
On the Zune? I don't know. I have two Zunes, but I've kind of reached the point where I only use them to listen to podcasts and maybe watch an occasional movie when I'm traveling. And other than that, I'm just, like everyone else has been saying, I'm not into downloading music. I don't want to buy songs. I have CDs that I bought years ago. I like them, keep them around, still put them in a CD player. And any other time, I can use Pandora or I can use an XM radio. And these people that make music today, these young kids, they can just get off my lawn.
Well, you stepped on the one thing that does really bug me about what they're doing with Zune is that they still don't have any way. I use my Zune almost exclusively for podcasts. I have it around so that, you know, I've got music and that's neat, but I use it mostly to listen to podcasts while I'm jogging, and it really bugs me that they don't have a play at speed thing.
Yes.
iPod's got it. Everybody's got it. I had it on my old Creative Zen Extra from like 5 years ago. And it's just, it's an obvious feature. And I just don't know why they haven't done that. I've actually written a program that's like 2/3 done that pipes things through all these different things and speeds up feeds as I download them because it drives me crazy to like,
that's cool.
Yeah. But it is frustrating that they don't just do that. And that they don't have the whole Zune store thing at a spot where someone else couldn't just write one for them, because if it was possible, I guarantee I'd be buying one.
Right. I wish the Silverlight media player could do the same thing.
Yes. Yep. They call it Trick Play. And, it's, you know, possible because in the Silverlight world, I've talked with people about that. It's possible because you can write your own codecs and stuff. It's, you know, remotely possible to do it yourself. It's just, it gets really tricky to not, you know, pitch up the audio. Another thing that was frustrating to me was that the Zune software kind of neat, I guess. It's got this Magic DJ, which does what Last.fm did 5 years ago, or what is it on iTunes? They've got the Music Genius or something.
Yeah, the Genius, which works kind of cool.
Yeah,
I just tried it with a 9, iTunes 9, and I thought it worked really well. It came up with some interesting mixes.
I tried the I forget what they call it, the DJ whatever feature on Zune, and it came up with a great mix of songs. It's back to that thing where I haven't bought every song that I like, so you know, it did pretty well at picking artists in a specific area, and it had a cool visualization. But I am comparing that to what I get on with these online services, and they'll surprise me with music I've never heard, which is kind of cool. The Zune, I've always been happy with Zune releases previously because they've always included cool new features for old hardware, and they didn't do that this time around. So I guess if you have a new Zune, then it's got all kinds of neat stuff and a browser and, you know, things none of us have played with, but the old Zune's got nothing. So.
Well, the other thing for me is, like, you know, having had an iPhone now for a while, I have zero interest in having a separate device for this, for, you know, playing my podcasts. Which kind of like you guys is the bulk of what I have on my iPhone these days. Just another device, another thing to keep charged, another thing to lug around if I need to. Like, I don't need it. I want fewer devices, not more.
Yeah. Scott Hanselman's been doing these Hansel and Minutia podcasts with Richard Campbell from .NET Rocks, and highly recommend those. They are very interesting, and they just fly through tons of information. And the last one, Richard Campbell was saying that, you know, it's, what's the point anymore with this stuff? Like, he was saying, do we really, who cares about Windows Mobile 7? Shouldn't it just be Windows 7? You know, like these devices are getting faster and smaller, and we're getting to a point where you can have a dual or a quad core thing that fits in your hand. And so instead of having like the Zune hardware and the separate operating system or stuff that runs there, and then Windows Mobile and Compact Framework and all this stuff, like just build one really cool thing. And I was thinking that today. I'm jogging and I'm like, okay, I've got my Zune with me, and then it doesn't have GPS and I don't have my phone or my email, and then I've got my phone at home with no music on it. And it's like, I'm really kind of done with having separate devices. I don't want a music player that delights me. I just want, you know, like one thing that's got my stuff.
Yeah, I'm totally hitting that point too. I've started putting things on my BlackBerry as much as I can. You know, I put my staple albums on there, like Miles Davis, Kind of Blue always goes on. You know, anything that I have that can possibly play music in any form, it always gets Kind of Blue on there. Got some other songs that usually go on everything, but you know, for the most part, that I just need a phone that gets Last.fm on it or something.
Have you seen Kind of Bloop? It's an
8-bit
that tribute.
That was awesome. Yes, that is awesome. I don't know how the guy got the rights. Well, actually, I figured out how he got the rights. He's got some other foundation, and people donated so that he could pay to have the rights to distribute his rework and remixing of it.
Yep. All right. Are we out of stuff?
I think that's it.
That's fine with me.
We've bunged. We've
orged.
We've orged. And we've sang.
Right.
A happy tune.
All right. That's it for this week. Catch us next week or whenever it comes out on Herding Code.